We sit in hipster bars and discuss if we're poetic enough. We pet our neuroses till they curl up.
So we're trying to record under, I think, very stressful circumstances today. A, we've got a small dog. B, I just fell down the stairs.
Yes, yes, she did. She let out a scream, the likes of which I've not heard outside of 70s horror movies. In fact, I didn't know people actually screamed like that in real life. I thought that was a pure affectation.
I was too confused at what was going on at the time to actually notice like the quality of my scream.
Well, let me assure you, it was a stonker. More of a wail. Yeah. Should I do it?
Sure. Wow.
I'm not exaggerating. Wow. Really, I should have got through there sooner.
The dog is now coming around to you going, is everything okay? I've already been scared once today.
I'm sorry. It's been stressful for all of us.
Yeah. I am now propped up on the floor, having crawled into the living room. Ash has set up all the recording equipment down here.
She's out of whiskey.
Has poured me a whiskey. I've called my father-in-law, who is a GP, who's advised me to put ice on it for a couple of hours and go to A&E.
And if anyone's wondering how I'm coping, I had a small chicken sandwich. and made me feel a lot better.
Yeah. So we're, I guess we're killing time while I ice my foot before going to A&E by recording this episode.
Yeah, enjoy.
You're welcome. sorry if the sound quality isn't as great in here.
Yeah, but we can't get her up the stairs. Perhaps ever again. Maybe a stair lift. I've always wanted a stair lift, but also I feel like...
I think the stairways is too, like... You need, like, a fairly straight stair for a stair lift.
Yeah, you're right. This is, again, once again, we come up by the problems posed by your choosing to live in a small ancient cottage in the middle of a field. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever the hell you are. My name is Ashley Merritson.
This is Sarah Worley-Hill.
And we are...
Demons and Dames!
Hello, everybody.
Hi, Ash.
Hey, everybody. I wasn't just talking to you. I was talking to those guys.
I thought you were talking to Callie.
The unseen masses.
Yeah.
The diehard fans.
The unseen shih tzu.
The unseen shih tzu. Highly visible shih tzu. Sarah's shih tzu threw up on my iPad this morning.
Oh, baby. Are you okay?
Gorgeous. It was so sweet. Don't worry, she's fine. So is my iPad, but frankly, who cares? The shih tzu. Let's talk about the shih tzu. No, let's not talk about the shih tzu. Let's talk about Artemisia Gentileschi.
Ooh.
Yes, she is the subject of today's episode. Now, I first heard about Artemisia Gentileschi, famous Baroque female painter, in case that needed clarification, in 2018 at the Edinburgh Fringe, when I went to see a show called It's True, It's True, It's True. It was by an experimental theatre company called Breach, starring a fantastic female company of three, and it was based on the transcript of her rape trial.
Goodness.
From the year 1612.
Did they even have rape trials in 1612? Is this a normal thing?
They were fairly unusual. Perhaps that's the reason the transcript survives. But it was an incredible production because they took it verbatim. You know, you really felt this voice speaking out to you across the centuries in a way that felt, well, you know, this was the year when Me Too really became a global phenomenon, in a way that felt entirely on trend, if that doesn't sound too reductive. It was filled with anachronism, there was physical tableau, they recreated paintings, and they really blended like the old language, the thuses and the thines, with a very kind of modern vernacular to create something very fresh. That's what I'm hoping to do with this episode.
Well, I look forward to your, you know, physical reenactments of her paintings as we record this.
Yeah, everyone else, you'll just have to imagine them. They're bang on. So, Artemisia Gentileschi was born on July the 8th, 1593. Although her birth certificate says 1590. I would be pissed off if my birth certificate made me three years older.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what my birth certificate does say? It says in large red letters, this child is not a citizen of Singapore. I was born in Singapore, so there's a kind of sense to it. Anyway, Artemisia was the eldest child of Tuscan painter Orazio Gentileschi, a very well-known painter in his time.
What was he well-known for, if you don't mind saying?
Classic Baroque figure painting, figurative paintings, quite idealized, but very much in the Baroque tradition. He was, in fact, a bit of a pal of Caravaggio, that old roisterer. Together, they were in court, accused of libel in 1603, and we have reason to believe that Caravaggio would have been popping around Orazio's gaff all the time as Artemisia was growing up. In fact, there's record of him going around there to borrow a pair of angel wings. Yeah.
I mean, I'm always doing that to my neighbours.
You've got to love a bro who you can rely on for a pair of angel wings.
Yeah.
Artemisia's mother died when she was 12 in childbirth, as was the way. And from that point, she's surrounded largely by men in this very artistic workshop environment. As a result, she learns to paint in a way that would not be in any way standard for women in that period. You know, she learns how to draw, she learns how to mix colour, and she learns how to apply it. And she shows a lot of talent. She shows a lot more talent than her brothers. And wonderfully, it would seem, Orazio recognises and encourages this. In fact, he's very much going around town bragging about her abilities. And we have an early painting of hers called Susanna and the Elders that she produced in 1610. So she would have been only 17. Did you study art at school, Sarah?
Yeah.
What were you painting when you were 17?
I was doing a lot of, like, circus scenes, to be honest. It was not a good period.
Yeah, this just doesn't sound a lot like my school experience. I was doing watercolours of bell peppers. also, I did a series of portraits of myself in the style of Tamara de Lempicka. It was full-on narcissistic. Artemisia, on the other hand, was painting scenes from the Book of Daniel, namely Susanna and the Elders. I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Susanna.
No, I'm not. Please tell me.
It's not the nicest, so how I'm going to put that. Susanna is a fair young housewife, that's housewife. One day she's having a bath in her garden and two church elders come along, spy on her, like what they see, approach her, tell her that if she does not make herself sexually available to them, they will destroy her reputation. Happily, King Daniel is on hand in non-king mode, but still a very reasonable fellow, to interrogate both the elders, and by finding discrepancies in their accounts, he's able to expose what has really happened. It's a really popular subject from, well, you know, the date I found is 1470, which seems very specific, but I'll go with it. Let's say the late 15th. It's a very popular subject because it's a great opportunity to show sexy, young, largely naked thing being perved on by a couple of old men.
There's a lot of Baroque painting in this period of biblical stories. Is that normal?
Very much so. The way I remember it, I'm afraid slightly outside my research, back to my art history classes of 20 years ago, but you had, you know, five types of painting during this period, the highest form of which would have been religious, followed by portraiture, followed by landscape or still life, followed by landscape or still life, followed by genre. Yes.
Would genre be like kind of classical inspired paintings?
More likely than not, you're going to see classical styling incorporated into religious paintings, because of course this is just after the Renaissance.
Yeah.
When we've seen kind of like humanist ideas kind of entering into the visual fields. I suppose what's most distinctive about the religious paintings from this period is the kind of use of anachronism. After the High Renaissance, we've seen this lovely little period called Mannerism. I'm a big fan. Lots of Madonnas with really long necks, and the church has become a bit angsty about it. Everything seems to be getting a bit affected, and they've made a call for a return to sort of realism. And as a result, we get this style of painting that's very much action-focused. Mm-hmm. And in order to create a sense of immediacy, we see people wearing contemporary, or what would have been contemporary clothes of the time. So it's set, you know, in it's religious in its origin, but it looks very contemporary. So to return to Susanna and the Elders, as painted by the 17-year-old Artemisia, it's unlike many of its predecessors in that it has a psychological aspect. It explores the trauma of the event. There's a kind of twist to Susanna's body that's quite horrifying. She's very obviously spectacularly awkward. The Elders kind of loom over her like a sort of dark shape. And she's very much a nude in the classical style. And I'm talking actually literally about the shape of her body. You know, she's got quite wide hips and she's got small breasts, which makes her a classical nude, which kind of gives her a kind of heroic aspect. I wanted to make clear that this has already been painted because we're about to get on to the most defining period of Artemisia's life, which is her rape and the subsequent trial against Agostino Tassi. And to note that she's already painting powerful women in moments of distress. So who is Agostino Tassi? He is a painter. The painters were spending time with the painters. If they weren't with the patrons, they were with the painters during this period.
So it's a very kind of tight clique.
It's a very tight clique. He specialises in... he does a good line in seascapes. The ability to paint which he acquired whilst enslaved on a galley.
Right.
It's as good a qualification as any.
Spending a lot of time looking at the ocean, I guess.
Absolutely. In 1611, he begins working with Orazio on decorating the vaults of the Casino del Vermuse inside the Palazzo. I'm going to say this just for fun. Pallavicini Rospigliosi.
I guess casinos like seascapes.
I don't think this casino is a gambling casino, by the way. I don't think it's a Vegas casino.
Okay, what kind of casino?
I'm not actually sure. It's got a different meaning in Italian, but I'm pretty sure it's not a gambling house.
I'm kind of disappointed. I was thinking that, like,
a nautical-themed casino would be a great thing indeed.
Well, exactly. It's like looking at these lovely seascapes make people feel kind of calm and yes, more susceptible to, you know, having their purses lifted from them.
Or giving them a stark vision of the ocean, so they'll have to cross to put space between them and their debtors. Orazio gets on well with Agostino, so he hires him as a private tutor for Artemisia. Again, this shows that he does have ambition for her. So Agostino, as I've already said, was a successful painter at the time, although largely forgotten, very pleasing. He was the son of a furrier, by which I don't mean someone who was... had more fur than the person next to him, but someone who presumably dealt in it.
Or a furry, which is probably a modern application.
Yes, I don't think... I fear it is, and I don't know what that says about us. He's adopted the name Tassi because he claims to be have to be the sort of, like, illegitimate offspring of a Marchese Tassi. He's 33 years old.
And he's already been imprisoned on a ship.
He has. Well, he's got quite a shady backstory. It will emerge. And I'm going to fast forward. In 1612, Orazio Gentileschi presses charges against Agostino Tassi for raping his daughter over a protracted period of time.
Ooh.
I probably shouldn't use the term rape, not because it wasn't a rape, but because that's not the basis, really, on which the charges were pressed. Rape was not a recognisable offence. Deflowering was.
Okay, so he's taking away her sellable assets, as it were, her virginity.
I couldn't have put it better myself. Yes, he has made her unmarriageable, and by doing so, he has also dishonoured the family. Incidentally, he's also accused of stealing a painting.
Oh, yeah.
In essence, he's a thief. So he has raped Artemisia, but that's not what he's really being tried for. It would have been fine if only he'd married her.
Well, that's all kinds of fucked up.
Wow, come on, it would be fine. Yeah. But he didn't put a ring on it. I retract that, don't say that. But yes. he wouldn't marry her.
So under the eyes of the law in the early 1600s at this time, rape was only rape if you consider the economic consequences to the woman's family.
And their reputation, of course, reputation and economic consequences are completely bound up. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So, and the idea is that this would have been absolutely fine, even in the eyes of the church at the time, if he had gone through and married her.
Absolutely.
That's so fucked up.
Artemisia speaks at the trial. She is, in fact, and this trial goes on for 7 months. They meander their way through a lot of witnesses. During the course of this trial, she is tortured.
What?
She is the accuser, but because the burden of proof is on her, they want to be absolutely sure she's not lying by repeatedly putting her to the question while subjecting her to torture.
Because they thought that torture brought to her confessions. This is something you see a lot in the witch trials in England at the same period.
You know, people still occasionally stray into that belief. She's tortured with sibile. These are sort of a contraption made of metal and rope, which is tightened around her fingers. And remember, she is a painter. Her hands are her trade. whilst these have been tightened, and incidentally this is taking place in open court, sat opposite Agostino Tassi, she is repeatedly asked whether or not Tassi has raped her. She says again and again and again, and we have this in the transcripts, it is true, it is true, it is true. She also says to him, to Agostino, she says, this is the ring you gave me. And these are your promises. She appears to be in remarkably eloquent, composed and confident woman. And we have her first person testimony of what happened to her.
That's incredible.
Part of me doesn't know whether or not I ought to read this. Another part of me thinks it reads as though it was written yesterday. And that makes it important that it's read.
And I think it's also important to let her be heard.
According to Artemisia, Tassi tricked his way into her room and started making unwanted offers of sex. In her words, he then threw me onto the edge of the bed, pushing me with a hand on my breast, and he put a knee between my thighs to prevent me from closing them. Lifting my clothes, he placed a hand with a handkerchief on my mouth to keep me from screaming. She fights back, and she fights back hard. I scratched his face and pulled his hair, and before he penetrated me again, I grasped his penis so tight that I even removed a piece of flesh. Good for her, eh?
Yeah.
But she cannot stop him. Afterwards, she rushes to a drawer and she gets out a knife. She says, I'd like to kill you with this knife because you have dishonored me. He opens his coat and says, here I am. She throws the knife, but he shields himself. Otherwise, she said, I might have killed him. Now, they would make something in court of the fact that she would have sex with him again after this period. But actually, it makes complete sense given the context, the social context. He promises to marry her. And so, essentially, continually postponing that, but using it as a means to convince her to continue sexual relations. Because obviously, she doesn't want him to leave her.
Yeah.
And she wants him to marry him.
So he's basically blackmailing.
Yes, exactly. As she said, what I was doing with him, I did only so that, as he had dishonoured me, he would marry me. Now, during the trial, Agostino's testimony is so unconvincing that the judge actually stops him several times to tell him to stop lying.
Wow.
He denies carnal relations. He denies attempting to have them. He claims to have visited the house to keep watch and to safeguard her honour. He, not satisfied with that, claims that Artemisia has written erotic letters. She is, by the way, unable to read or write. And that she has slept with 5 different men and had incestuous relations with her father, who once sold her for a loaf of bread. In fact, not only her, but all the women in the family, including her dead mother, are whores. The house is a virtual bordello. He goes for
Jesus it. Christ.
The good news is, it doesn't work. No one buys it, especially once we learn a bit more about Agostino's shady past. He is already a convicted rapist. He has previously been in jail. He is known to have raped both his sister-in-law, that's incest, FYI, and by the standards of the time, and just rape by the standards of today, and his previous wife. His wife, his ex-wife, is currently missing, and he's believed to have hired bandits to kill her.
Jesus Christ.
Assuming she's not died, he is currently still married, which means that he was certainly never going to marry Artemisia. It turns out that he was obsessed with her, and not just him, but a good crony of his, a chap called Cosimo Quarley, have been stalking her.
They've been stalking Artemisia?
They've been stalking Artemisia, spying on her, hiring men to watch her.
This sounds remarkably like Susan and the Elders.
It really does. How incredible that she painted that before this happened. It just goes to show perhaps the popularity of that theme during that time and the vividness with which she managed it showed what a sort of like plausible kind of behaviour it was and common thing it was. Now, unfortunately, we don't have a verdict. It's funny how the verdict goes missing. Close but no cigar. And there's some speculation over exactly what punishment was meted out to Agostino. In some places I've read that he was sentenced to 2 years, but served only 8. Others say he was set free immediately. Why? Because of the Pope. The Pope thought he was dope. during this period in Rome, if you've got a papal favour, even if you've got papal favour, there's nothing more you can hope for. And Pope Innocent the X, that's a 10, right?
Yeah.
10. Pope Innocent the 10th once said, "Tassi is the only artist who has never disappointed me."
Fuck me. So we do know he was found guilty, we just don't know what the sentence was.
Yeah, we think he was found guilty. Forgive me if I sound a bit vague on this, it's because everything I read is so contradictory.
That's fair.
I've not read anywhere that he was found innocent. And certainly, judging by the transcript, he seems to, you know, not been winning any favours during the trial. So in the aftermath of the trial, Artemisia, although she has ostensibly, we believe, won, nonetheless under something of a cloud, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's all a bit of a...
She's not marriageable material.
Happily, she does get married. She gets married to the cousin of someone who testified on her behalf at the trial, a moderately successful painter called Pietro Antonio de Stietesi, and they immediately leave town. That's important.
Good.
They go somewhere else. They make a relatively fresh start. They go to Florence.
Nice.
Where you want to be in the 17th century art field. Though actually, everywhere was pretty great in Italy then. They go to Florence. Orazio will have presumably written to the Medici Grand Duchess, Christine of Lorraine, who is someone he has worked for, won favour from in the past. And as a result, Artemisia is able to set herself up as a relatively successful court painter. While there, she does incredible things as an artist. She has great relationships with some of the most respected artists of her time. She becomes a member of the Accademia del Disegno.
Is this something that was usual for female painters?
No, she was the very first woman to become a member of that academy. The Accademia dell'Arte del Disegno had been founded in 1563. By Cosimo de' Medici. Previous members include, you know, lowly little no names like Michelangelo, Vasari, and Bronzino. And it's comprises a select group of artists who are responsible for supervising the artistic production within the Medici state.
That's pretty incredible.
So it's a high honour, to say the least. She also has some very intellectually stimulating acquaintances, most notably with Galileo Galileo. Galileo Galileo. Oh, you're rubbish. Hey,
you
everyone
explain.
Out there, will you sing along with me, please? She also has a love affair. Yes, between 1616 and 1620, we know this. Because the letters were found in 2011. I have not read them. I'd love to. It was passionate, though, and it was with a wealthy nobleman. And her husband actually knew about it. We know this because he'd write postscripts on the letters. That's how he'd carry his own correspondence on.
So he was evidently fairly supportive of what was going on.
He was a powerful ally.
Okay.
A financial supporter. Artists in this period were entirely dependent upon
the wealthy patrons.
On their patrons, yeah.
Or the church.
Or the church. So after 8 years in Florence, Artemisia goes back to Rome. We think that's because rumours are probably circulating about her affair with the Florentine nobleman. And in some senses, while she was certainly a successful painter there, she was never prosperous. The Florentines were quite a delicate and refined stock compared to the, like, lusty, bloody Romans. And her scandal may have served her well in some ways, but not in others. Either way, she has financial and legal problems. She's been covering the debts of her husband, who she falls out with and leaves behind when she returns to Rome alone.
Oh, so she leaves both the lover and the husband behind in Florence.
Mm-hmm. She takes a daughter with her, though. She's had 4 children, one of whom survived.
Oh.
I mean, standard odds for the period, one fears.
Yeah.
So Artemisia will spend 10 years in Rome, where she will be associated with another academy. She will be celebrated with a portrait carrying the inscription, "To paint a wonder is more easily envied than imitated."
Is that a portrait of herself?
That's a portrait of herself.
Oh,
she will be painted. She also does lots of great self-portraits, as we will find out when we look a bit more at her work. She's then in Naples from 1630. In many ways, her career at this point is fairly standard for an artist of international renown during this period, with the one distinguishing fact in that she's a woman. Mm-hmm. And that is highly unusual. When she goes to Naples, she sets up a studio. She spends some time in London at the court of Charles I.
Ooh!
Yeah. Orazio is already over there. He's been there since 1626 with her three brothers. She arrives in 1638 and presumably gets the hell out of Dodge before the Civil War in 1642.
Yeah, one would hope so.
Well, we know she's certainly back in Naples by 1650 and still accepting commissions in 1654. Many speculate that she probably died in the plague of 1656 that killed a generation of Neapolitan artists, by which time she would have been a highly respectable 63 years old.
So we have just gone from birth through to death by plague.
Best way to go.
Tell us about her paintings.
Ew. Well, she had a very distinct specialism. She specialised or was celebrated for painting pictures of strong, suffering women from myth, allegory, and the Bible. She also did a strong line in really vibrant violence.
So is this women being the actors of violence or the subjects of violence?
Being the actors, you could say. So there's actually a tradition that the subject she was painting belongs to, and it's called The Power of Women.
Ooh, I like that.
You think you're going to like it.
Oh, okay.
You won't like it in its early incarnation. In its early incarnation in the Middle Ages, the power of women subjects, and these are subjects like, from classical subjects like Phyllis riding Aristotle to biblical ones like Samson and Delilah or Salome to witches to genre images of wives dominating their husbands.
I mean, so far I'm on board.
Yeah, so these were seen as comedic inversions of male-dominated sexual hierarchy.
Oh.
Yeah, pointedly ridiculous. In
less
fact,
interested.
The genre images of wives dominating husbands were called the battle for trousers. By the Baroque period, however, this has become a more complex site of conflict and a way of kind of exploring gender. So, what's distinctive about Artemisia's paintings of power of women subjects like Yael and Sisera, Judith and her maidservant, and Esther, is that these characters lack conventional feminine traits, you know, like sensitivity and timidness and weakness and propensity to fainting fits.
So she's portraying women as being strong.
Yes. And pissed off. And she is celebrated for this. And this is very much like Artemisia is someone who gets a lot of attention in the 20th century. Up until then, she's considered something of an anomaly. Occasionally touched upon as an object of interest for her grotesquely unwomanly style. So like a 19th century critic talking about her, Magdalene, says, "No one would have imagined that it was the work of a woman. The brushwork was bold and certain, and there was no sign of timidness."
Goodness.
And the painting that people tend to come back to again and again when talking about Artemisia Gentileschi is her Judith and Holofernes. Do you know much about Judith?
I do not. Please enlighten me.
Holofernes. This is a story that takes place in the Book of Judith. So, the Book of Judith, get ready for one hell of a word, is a deuterocanonical book.
What does that mean?
Okay, so these are books or passages that are considered canonical by the Catholic Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, and the Oriental Orthodox Churches, and the Assyrian Church of the East, but are considered non-canonical by Protestants.
Okay, so this is part of the Old Testament, presumably.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. In the story, in the Book of Judith, Judith is...
I'm kind of guessing this is why this wasn't in, like, you know, the Bible that I spent a lot of time reading at a Presbyterian boarding school.
I know, it's a shame because it sounds like it would be a lot of fun. So Judith is a really gorgeous, really brave young widow. And when her country is invaded, she seduces and then beheads the enemy general, Holofernes. Love it. Night as he lies in a drunken stupor. She takes his head back to her countrymen. The Assyrians disperse, and though she's courted by many, she never weds.
Cool.
The point on which painters fixate is the moment of beheading, and it's a really popular subject. What makes Artemisia's so notoriously unwomanly is the emphasis on blood.
So it's quite a gory depiction.
Definitely gory. Holofernes is lying head towards the viewer on a white bed, all the better to show up the blood spurting everywhere. Judith and her maid are meaty, energetic, sleeves rolled up, faces focused. A blade runs down the centre of the composition.
Interesting. I'm trying, when you're talking about beheading someone, which is something I often think about, as does
any... You're alive.
Exactly. I can't imagine how you would depict the beheading of someone in a way that wasn't bloody. I mean, that's your arterial kind of blood is going to be spurting a hell of a lot.
Well, a lot of paintings of Judith and Holofernes from the late Renaissance, early Baroque period, show Judith post-beheading holding the head.
Okay.
So there's a lot less blood. In Caravaggio's, and you know Caravaggio,
yes,
king of gore, Holofernes is pressing his hand to his throat, so that's putting something of a tap on the blood. This is by far the bloodiest. I mean, one, you know.
And Artemisia just lets it all out.
She lets it roar. Roberto Longhi, who wrote about her in 1916 in a text called Gentilesque Padre e Figlia, so Gentilesque father and daughter. She doesn't get her own big criticism. He writes, who could think, in fact, that over a sheet so candid and so brutal and terrible a massacre could happen? It's natural to say this is a terrible woman. A woman painted all this? There's nothing sadistic here. Instead, what strikes the most is the impassivity of the painter, who is even able to notice how the blood, spurting with violence, can decorate with two drops the central spurt. One imagines a measure of detachment in order to be able to paint so much blood and so much detail. You know, this isn't the frenzy of expressionism. You know, it's hyper-gore in a hyper-realistic style. Now, a lot of people, by which I mean, not just, you know, yes, it's in a lot of feminist literature, but no, it's very popular to take an autobiographical approach to the paintings of Artemisia Gentileschi, because don't we all kind of want to see a bit of a repressed vengeance fantasy there?
Yeah.
It's a nice idea. She painted this before the rape as well.
So this is just her own kind of innate sense of power and realism.
Well, you know, feminist literature kind of tends to focus on this not so much as the realization of a rape revenge fantasy, but the kind of like as a socially liberated woman fighting masculine oppression. What's one of the great aspects of this painting is that there are two women together. The maidservant is usually a crone. Because that's how maidservants are painted, and also because it sort of provides a balance to the beauty and youth of Judith. In this, she's another young woman, and there's a very kind of, it feels almost like a sort of rebellion or revolution. In 1970, I don't know how much you know about feminist art history.
Not nearly as much as I should.
Well, what really kicked feminist art history off was a article by Linda Nochlin, forgive me if I've pronounced that wrongly, Linda, from in the 1970s called Why Have There Been No Great Women Artists? And in this article, she questions the definition of great artist to begin with, important, and then essentially points the finger at the negative impact of oppressive institutions that have stopped the recognition of women. Artemisia essentially becomes a banner bearer for like the reappraisal of the female artist in history.
Okay.
Now, I am in no way disputing that female artists have been
systematically underappreciated.
Absolutely. Did you know that in the National Gallery, as of 2018, only 20 of its 2,300 works were painted by women?
Holy fuck.
And it was really unusual to be a painter of international renown during this period, to be a female painter of international renown. You know, the doors of academies and guilds were closed to them. You know, the door of the Academy della Arte de something or other in Florence was opened for the first time to Artemisia. And, you know, there were other female painters. And again, it's one always has to tread a fine line between sort of downplaying the fact that there were achievements being made by art and by women during this period and, you know, the fact that it was made almost impossible for them to be put on record.
I really want to see some of the paintings. Mm. I feel like this would be a great one to do as like a live event or
like,
something.
Yeah,
so
you
could
be really
like
good.
With the PowerPoint.
It would be hilarious. I'd love to do some PowerPoint shit. I think there's a danger that if we come at Artemisia's work entirely from a feminist art history perspective, we lose some of her achievements as a painter in a way that transcends gender and some of the more nuanced and radical way with which she plays with sexuality. Mm-hmm. Because it's not so simple as female victim of rape, female victim of systematic, you know, sort of like oppression of female creativity,
yeah.
You know?
And from what you've said, she actually was quite successful contemporarily. She's the queen of, sorry, the king of England is inviting her to come paint at his court. She is in several previously all-male, what are they called? Art
academies.
Art academies.
That's Italian for academy.
It's just, so it sounds like she's doing an amazing job at the time and is very, very successful.
Absolutely. And I think because to our 21st century eyes, these, and indeed to our 20th century eyes, these sort of depictions of Judith, say, slaying Holofernes seem very shocking. We don't realise that actually, although it would have been definitely at the extreme perimeters of taste for the time, they were not by any means unusual. Like, there's a real Baroque fetish for women killing men.
Hmm.
And, you know, these aren't being consumed by women. These are being consumed by wealthy male patrons. You know, in the Renaissance, and I mentioned already that traditionally we would see Judith holding the head,
mm-hmm,
post-beheading. That's very much the case in the Renaissance. But come the Baroque, it's getting more and more gory. There's this painting by Johann Liss, and in the foreground is the bleeding stump of Holofernes' neck.
Ooh.
It is so gross. So gross. And then we have Caravaggio's, which is Judith slaying Holofernes' beheading, which is the moment of the beheading, and it's very active.
Where he's clutching his neck, he said.
In some ways,
like,
I think
spurting out.
What Artemisia's done is she's married together the kind of like anatomical sort of like grisliness of Johann Liss's version with the drama of Caravaggio's. And I think it's fair to say that this art kind of is erotic.
Okay. So there's something about the blood and the gore that is sexualized.
Holofernes is always on a bed. You know, there's a kind of dominatrix fantasy that's inherent in all this. The women are spectacularly dressed. If you've ever wondered what to wear to behead an enemy general, trust me, it's damask and pearls. There's this, and that's, you know, that's catering the kind of luxurious sense of, you know, the desire for luxury and refinement of the time. But there's an odd juxtaposition, you know. Looking at these paintings, you know, you kind of suddenly remember that that sex and death are very closely entwined in the 16th century, certainly. I mean, I can only speak to British culture of the time, but, you know, for the Elizabethans, notoriously, the little death was the orgasm, was common Indian for orgasm.
Yeah.
And that when Eve ate the apple, she brought both sex and death into the world.
Yeah. And for women as well, sex was such an inherently life-risking activity,
yeah,
because of the mortality rates of childbirth.
Yeah, and sex is a sin and inevitably casts one's mind to the final judgment and what's to follow. And I think, and we see that in other sort of power of women kind of like paintings from the time. Artemisia also does a painting of Yale and Sisera, who I mentioned earlier. Now, I was not familiar until I started looking into this with the story of Yale, which features in the Book of Judges, in the Hebrew Bible. She kills Sisera to deliver Israel from the troops of King Jabin. So another story of political murder committed by a woman who uses her seductive wiles in order to infiltrate the enemy camp. It's all very Mata Hari, come to think of it. She kills Sisera by putting a nail in his ear, a nice bit of sort of like reverse penetration.
That made my ear itch when you said that.
Oh, do you want to go get something?
Never
put anything smaller than a finger.
Thud. Kind of, as you can hear the nail being hammered into your head, that really freaks me out.
Love those banging beats. DJ Yale is in the house. Yale was such a popular heroine that ladies of the period, fine society ladies, sometimes chose to have their portraits painted holding a hammer and a spike.
Wow.
And the kind of gender play aspect of this, because that's what this is, isn't it? It's about reversing genders and taking a salacious enjoyment from it, you know, because one has to assume that people enjoyed these paintings if they were willing to pay so much from them. You know, Judas slaying Holofernes does not inspire contemplation in the way Christ on the cross might.
Yeah. But because they're kind of nominally, at least, Christian subjects,
yes,
they're kind of accepted by the church.
So this chap, who I've never heard of before, called Pseudophilo, wrote about Yale in the book Liber Antiquitatum Biblicarum in the 1st century CE, so contemporary-ish, you know, it's early days of Christianity. He wrote that, "And while he was dying, Sisera said to Yale, 'Behold, pain has taken hold of me, Yale, and I die like a woman.'" Fairly explicit, that. I want to return again to the fact that by catering to the somewhat salacious taste in images of beautiful women executing strong men, it's not impossible that Artemisia was in some way parlaying to her own scandal.
So she's kind of using it, taking her reputation and then making it something that she can profit from.
Taking advantage of her fame from the rape trial to cater to a niche market in sexually charged female dominant art for male punters. It's not out of the question.
Sounds very Mata Hari to me.
I mean, if she did so, who can blame her? And she actually paints her own image into many of her paintings.
Interesting.
Is this, again, is this a rape vengeance sort of like wish fulfillment? Or is this someone, perhaps somewhat cynically, responding to the demands of her public?
I think it's quite possible for it to be both.
And either way, she is playing against gendered type in a way that is entirely laudable. She's conscious, you know, one doesn't want to, it's again, and I return to my point from earlier, you know, like, it's about appreciating the fact that she is a female painter in this period without making it entirely, or her painting, about her being female. But she is certainly conscious of her own somewhat anomalous status, and maybe that's why she chooses to make sort of gender play such a big part of what she does. One of my, I'd say probably my favourite painting of hers, it's from 1638. So she's older, you know, she's 45 years old, and it's called Self-Portrait as the Allegory of Painting. Now, abstract concepts in this period, the allegory of music, the allegory of poems.
Allegory poems. In this sense mean just like kind of the physical embodiment?
The physical embodiment.
Okay.
Allegories were invariably, exclusively represented by female figures.
Like the muses.
Like the muses. A male artist cannot paint himself as an allegory.
Ah.
But a female artist can. So in an amazing piece of sort of artistic chutzpah, she casts herself as the embodiment of painting, and it's an incredible piece of art. She is beautiful, but quite muscular, you know, she's quite substantial, actually, and there's something very sexy about that. She's looking away from the viewer, focusing on her work. So this isn't the painter as craftsman, this is the painter as artist, as innovator. And she was one hell of a painter. You know, she had a way of painting, bring female figures to life. She had immense skill and talent in the handling of colour and the use of composition and the building of depth and the distinctive sort of extremes of light and dark of the Baroque period. In fact, Italian critic Roberto Longhi, who I quoted earlier, talking about what a terrible woman she must be, wrote in 1916 that, and this is one of those, backhanded compliments we see a fair bit in sort of when men are praising women during this period. But he said, she was the only woman in Italy who ever knew about painting, colouring, drawing, and other fundamentals. I think what he's trying to say is, it hurts him to say it, but even he must say, she's really, really bloody good. And her achievements were extraordinary. First woman to become a member of said Florentian Academy. She had an international clientele. She worked in the highest echelons of society with patrons who included the Duke of Tuscany, the Philip IV of Spain, and Charles I of England. And she died an immensely wealthy woman.
Oh, that's very nice.
I highly recommend you go and look at some of her paintings. We will be posting some on Instagram at the same time as this podcast drops. And good news, the National Gallery in London will be having an exhibition of her works starting in April 2020.
Oh, I can't wait to go.
No, we will go and we'll take some photos of ourselves. And we'll also look at some of what, you know, Artemisia has done. But we'll definitely take some photos of ourselves too.
I think she would appreciate that.
I think she would. So, self-portrait. What is it? An allegory on podcasting.
So, Ash, what is it that you want people to take away from her story?
I think what I would like people to take away is that this isn't a simple story about a woman who was raped and spent the rest of her life working it out on canvas. This is about a woman who was raped and overcame that through determination and talent to become one of the most exciting artists of her generation in a time when it was not easy to do that as a woman, who was able to take her own victimization and go far beyond it into exploring the different ways in which women could inhabit a canvas. Revenge is to oversimplify it.
It almost belittles her achievement.
It really does, yeah. Because she lived for a long time, and I like to think she left it way behind her.
Well, I think that is brilliant.
Yeah, good. Well, I'm glad. I hope you enjoyed that, Sarah.
I did so much. I cannot wait to go look at her paintings and actually look at them in April at the National Gallery.
It's gonna be wonderful. I'm really, really, really excited about it.
Okay.
Well, that's us. You have been listening to
Demons and Dames. Bye.
We sit in coffee shops and discuss the subject of love. We speak of our men folk, then we give up.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Demons and Dames.
We will respectfully encourage you to rate us, to review us, and to recommend us to your friends.
And enemies.
It might make you like them a bit better. You can follow us on Instagram at Demons Dames Pod, on Twitter at Dames Demons.
Or you can get in touch with us via Facebook or demonsanddames@gmail.com.
Bye!
He says that he loves her, but never does anything for her that she couldn't order.
Testing 1, 2, 3. I just got back from A&E. I have my foot in a really weird boot thing, and it turns out I have probably broken, or almost definitely broken, one of the bones where my big foot connects to my foot. So isn't that cool?